Well, it gives me great pleasure to have with us an expert who can lift the fog on all these questions. We have the BC anti-flipping tax, more in Portland. Are there any exception to that tax? We can talk federal buyers ban, but is there any workarounds available in that? There's a lot of inquiries on, can I walk away from my deal and is all I lose is my deposit? Well, there's a lot of ifs and buts and maybes to be discussed, and the mistakes buyers make and sellers make. Well, we need an expert in that, and we have one with us, Stuart Ross from Gardner & Harris. And Stuart, 12 years of experience in law, very sort of a broad spectrum of legal services from wills and estates to residential conveyancing. Very important real estate development. We all have been in complex subdivisions where you need a guiding hand alongside you. So welcome, Stuart.
Thank you, Ozzy. Happy to be here.
Well, the thing is that you are every day in the kind of a business to paper what people in the market, the realtors, the buyers, the owners, we can figure something out. We have an idea. Let's do it. But what we really need is somebody on our side to say, hey, just a minute, let's paper this properly, all right?
Absolutely. There's tricks and traps everywhere, especially in the current landscape with all these new taxes and changes to the legislation coming almost monthly, it seems.
Yeah, it does. They seem to sit around the table and say, okay, well, how else can we raise money or zap them or blame somebody else for our shortfalls? But the big one coming up is January 1 is the BC flipping tax. And Brandon and I talked about it, but the legality is really, the devil is always in the detail. Can you tell us a little bit about the BC anti-flipping tax?
Yeah, of course. Well, the BC anti-flipping tax, the intended purpose of the act is fairly self-explanatory from the title itself. That is, the province is trying to curtail real estate investors from flipping properties. This is an attempt by the province to encourage a buy and hold approach as opposed to investors assigning or selling immediately following completion. So basically what this says is that effective January 1, so in a few weeks from now, if you sell a property which was owned for less than 2 years, you're likely subject to the anti-flipping tax. If you sell within the first year of ownership, this means that you're going to pay an additional 20% tax in the income that you earn. So you're going to pay a significant amount more tax than you otherwise would. After the first year, between year one and two, there's a sliding scale depending on the amount of tax. So after the first year, it's not set at 20%. It gradually slides down to nothing when you hit that 2 year mark.
So let's presume now, I bought a property 1 year and 8 months ago and sell it in February 2025. Taxes due?
Well, if you would hit the 2 year mark by that February date, there would be no taxes due at that point. It depends on when you closed on the transaction.
Right. So the date of the transaction is the key.
Right. Now, what I will say is that for pre-sales, there is an exception. So if you entered into a pre-sale contract a year ago and you close the year from now, they count that year that you had that contract for the pre-sale as one of the 2 years. So if you bought a pre-sale a year ago, you only have to wait 1 year from now before you won't incur any of those taxes.
That's an important point. Like myself, I have a couple of units coming due in May, but I did the pre-sale and I'm, I guess, in early 2023. So I'd beat the 2 years I'd gone and I wouldn't have to pay the tax.
That's right. You'd beat the 2 years at that point.
Yeah. So at least one good thing.
Yeah. However, I should note if you buy an assignment, so that is if you're the assignee of a transaction, the time starts to run from when the contract was assigned to you, not when the original buyer got it. So if the original buyer had it for a year and assigned it to you, your clock is reset. So you don't get credit for the time that the first buyer had it.
Well, that's the devil of the details that we just have to know. Like, let's say I'm closing in May right now on my units, but you and I have a conversation. You would like to buy it. I sign it to you today. It starts today and you have 2 years to wait again. So Well, you can get gray hair over it. Well, never mind the BC flipping tax, but what about the foreign buyers ban?
Yeah, and I'll get there. And there's one more thing I would like to, just because it comes up if, with the last thing, my last thought with the anti-flipping tax. And when I said usually you will have to pay it, there are a few carve-outs for when you won't have to pay it, but they're mostly extenuating circumstances. So if you have to sell a property within 2 years because of divorce, death, or bankruptcy, so pretty unfortunate situations, the tax will not apply in those cases. But there's really no other workarounds other than divorce, death, and bankruptcy, or things akin to those situations.
Well, the other thing is that it is really a tax on income. It's not a, people think it's a capital gains tax, so it's 66% I have to, no, it's on income, just like the federal anti-flipping tax.
Exactly. So it's on, so it's actually worse for the taxpayer because it's not based on the 66% or the 50% after the, before the 250, it's based on dollar one of your profit.
All right. Oh, well, at least we now know.
For better or worse.
So foreign buyers tax.
Yeah, moving on to the foreign buyers tax. In a nutshell, again, this is almost exactly what it sounds like. And this is a ban on foreign buyers purchasing residential property in Canada. And this is federal legislation. So unlike the anti-flipping tax, which is only in BC, this applies across the country. So the ban was originally set to expire in January 1 of 2020. So again, in a couple of weeks, but it's been now extended until January 1, 2027. So perhaps if there's a change in government, this might get repealed or something like that. But at present, this is set to expire January 1, 2027. So almost another 2 years. And as I mentioned, generally, this is a ban on foreign buyers purchasing residential property in Canada. Now, the definition of foreign buyer is fairly straightforward in this case. It is anybody that's not a Canadian citizen or a permanent resident. So there are some exemptions for if you have work permits or student permits that last a specified amount of time, either 6 months or a year, respectively, I believe, then you're allowed to purchase residential property in Canada. But in a nutshell, that's the prohibition. If you're not a Canadian citizen or permanent resident, you're precluded from buying residential property in Canada.
Well, I guess the more interesting question is how does the ban work in sort of a workaround situation, possibly?
Well, there are a few things when people ask about workarounds, foreign buyers, foreign investors, that I like to draw their attention to. Firstly, that this ban only applies to residential properties. So that means that foreign buyers are still allowed to invest in either commercial or industrial properties. They're not precluded from purchasing those non-residential units. Also, when I say this applies off the across the country, it doesn't apply in absolutely every area of the country. What has been done is they have said you are not allowed to purchase, a foreign buyer is not allowed to purchase a property in a census metropolitan area. And they have a map on their site that shows you where these areas are. So there are some tucked away little areas where you are outside of a census metropolitan area where a foreign buyer would be able to purchase residential property. For example, I just had a deal recently close in close to Britannia Beach, British Columbia. And looking at the map, that's outside of a census metropolitan area. So the foreign buyer was able to purchase there. There are some other fairly straightforward or intuitive exemptions. For example, the spouse, if a spouse is a foreign buyer and they're spouse and they have a spouse that's a Canadian citizen, the foreign spouse is allowed to go on title with the citizen. They'd still pay the additional property transfer tax for the amount that they're acquiring, but they wouldn't be prohibited from purchasing in that case.
Talking about transfer tax, isn't there also a foreign buyer's tax if they buy a commercial tax?
Yes, actually, well, that's just what I was alluding to there. So that's the additional 20% foreign buyer's tax, where if I mean, it comes up few and far between now because of the prohibition, but in the case where you do have a foreign buyer, they that does get work their way onto title through some exemption, if they're not a Canadian citizen or a permanent resident, they pay an additional 20% property transfer tax, which is the 2% and 3% on the first 100 and 200,000 respectively, that everybody's familiar with paying when they have
So, and
property
I would
transfer
pay
tax.
that under commercial properties as well, right? To pay a foreign buyer's tax.
There's no foreign buyer tax on commercial property. There is property transfer tax, but
Oh, so,
not
okay.
foreign buyer's tax.
Be thankful for small mercies.
Of course. The one other workaround that I'm constantly asked about for the foreign buyer's tax is if there's anything you can do if you have a company buy the property, because when we're speaking about, foreign buyers, we're usually thinking of individual people that aren't Canadian citizens or permanent residents. So what if I had a company go on title as opposed to an individual person? And this is addressed in the regulations. So you can have a company go on, obviously, go on title for a residential purchase. And what the regulations say is this is permissible so long as that foreign buyers, collectively, the foreign buyers own less than 10% of the voting shares of that company. So, for example, you could set up XYZ Corp with the foreign buyer owning 9% of the voting shares, and then have the balance of the shares owned by somebody who's a Canadian citizen. You would then probably have the buyer put in the purchase price as a shareholder loan to the company in order to acquire the property, and then you could potentially readjust the shareholdings after the ban is removed. Hopefully.
Interesting. Well, that, and that's really not that difficult. My son works right now in Thailand, and all properties can be bought by a foreigner, but 49% have to be owned by a local, and then and that's how they have their workaround as well. It's complicated, but clearly you need a lawyer. Don't just assume that you know the regulations. You need somebody who does this all the time. So anything else
That's
on
right.
foreign buyers ban we should know?
That's basically it. There are, if you're really looking into it, I can always walk people through it and go through their particular situation. It's depend, like I say, you'd have to look at the nature of the property, what its use is, where it's located, if it's going to be owned by a company, if there's work, if people have work permits in place with remaining year or 6 months or something like that. So it would depend on a particular situation. So I mean, I'm happy always to take calls, that sort of thing, to tell somebody if they might qualify for an exemption.
Well, that and then we have the UHT tax, the form, they already own property, but now they have to pay tax on it. I mean, I always keep thinking, we own as Canadians so much of Palm Springs. How would we feel if the US all of a sudden said, you now have to pay a foreign buyer's tax? But lots of people never even heard of UHT tax.
Plus the speculation and vacancy tax and the Vancouver vacancy bylaw, and I expect probably more to come.
Well, you're really very cheerful today. Well, the one thing I get a lot of questions now, but there are some developments that made the news in the last little while, and we talked about it on the channel, that some developers have a problem, and now some buyers actually talk about backing out of the deal, and they seem to think, well, all they have to do is lose the deposit. But I think this the consequence of backing out of the deal may be, something to be discussed with your lawyer.
This is something that I think there is a huge misconception out there about the consequences of backing out of your contract. And in my seat, I hear a lot of what you're referring to there. And that's where the client comes and they're basically thinking, well, I'm okay with giving up my deposit, but it doesn't end there. If a buyer backs out of a contract, they can be liable for far more than the amount of the deposit. There was a recent decision out of Kelowna this past July that provides a really illustrative example. This was the Mandel and Fong case. In that case, the buyer agreed to purchase a property for about $1.1 million in and around March of 2022, and it was set to complete in June of 2022. However, when the buyer attempted to obtain financing, the property didn't appraise out to the purchase price, and they were ultimately unable to complete. The seller relisted the property in November of 2022. So, anyone who consistently watches the real estate market knows that March of 2022 was the zenith of the real estate market in British Columbia and had dropped significantly by the end of the year. So the property in this case was ultimately sold for $740,000, so
Wow.
significantly less than the 1.1 and change that the buyers had agreed to pay. So the result in that case is that the buyers were on the hook for approximately
Wow.
$350,000. The difference between the contract price and the reduced sale price that the sellers were forced to take. So I think that kind of case provides a good example that you can certainly be on the hook for more than just your deposit if you back out of a deal.
Even though you could technically argue that, well, it wasn't really their fault. The market changed and they wouldn't get the financing, all that. But that's the key that you have to be very careful. I mean, for instance, what mistake did this buyer make in that case?
Well, the mistakes that I was able to glean, I mean, if I was able to advise the buyer right from the beginning, I would say that really the biggest mistake they probably made was removing the financing subject before they actually had an approval from the lender. Now, in a super hot market like there was at the beginning of 2022, there are a lot of buyers that get wrapped up in bidding wars, and there is a lot of pressure to make subject-free offers or to remove your subjects quicker than you otherwise would if they have clauses in there that allow the sellers to insist that you remove subjects or collapse the deal or something like that. So, if buyers are going to jump into a really hot market like this, what they should probably have is some pre-approved financing in place. They should probably go to their lender or their broker prior to even making offers and say, "What do I qualify for? How much can I borrow from you?" Also, in this case, as I mentioned, it didn't appraise out. So the bank actually, in looking at it, said, "Well, we don't think it's worth $1.1 million despite the market." So the buyer should probably also ensure that they have some extra rainy day cash on hand in case they need to bridge the gap between the purchase price and the appraisal price. So, for example, if they had bought it for 1.1 and the bank said, "Well, it's only worth $1 million," they could have still got their financing, but they would have to bridge that gap of $100,000 to make up the appraisal shortfall. So, I mean, those are some of the things that especially if you're jump if you don't have time to properly remove your financing subject in a regular market. Everybody knows you sign your contract, you say it's subject to financing, you
Yeah.
have a couple of weeks to remove it, you send the contract to the bank, they say all good, then you remove your subjects with the seller. But in a super hot market, you often have to go in subject free, as most
Yeah.
people use the expression, and or remove your subjects more quickly. They'll only give you 5 days or 3 days to remove your financing subjects. And buyers feel that pressure because maybe they've been shut out of several deals or something like that, or they've
That's
been
insane.
outbid. So they feel they have to go in without
Well, and
subjects or a
that's you know, I always keep making the point, for some reason when there's a hot market, we think it's a good market if five buyers wrestle each other to the ground in the living room of the seller and one emerges victoriously and pays 100,000 more than the guy even was asking for, right? But what the buyer in all cases should do is subscribe to my free OzBuzz newsletter, because in March of 2022, my headline was "The High is in Place." Now, I used Surrey as an example. When we were almost $2 million for any old house in Surrey, I thought to myself, that's it. And it was the high was that spring period. So in any case, it's a very sad thing. Now, on the other hand, what about the developer or the owner? What kind of obligations do they have?
Well, I was just touching on the buyers there. So, the buyer's ability to complete or responsibility to complete doesn't really matter that they can't get financing. That's not the seller's problem. But In the case where a buyer is not completing or threatening to not complete, the seller also has some obligations as well, especially if they want to put themselves in the best position going forward. So in these cases, the seller needs to make sure they are in a position to close, or they may lose the ability to sue the buyer. This means that the seller needs to do everything on their end to complete the deal. So this might mean that you have to come into the lawyer's office to sign your sales documents. We probably have to order a payout statement if you have a mortgage on your property. Even if you're thinking the buyer's already told me that they're not going to complete on this transaction or something like that, there are some legal theories that allow you to call this an anticipatory breach or something like that. But to put yourself in the best position, you need to put yourself through the paces, sign the documents, order your mortgage statement. And so then that way on the closing date, you can have your lawyer send a letter to the buyer's lawyer saying, our client remains ready, willing, and able to complete this transaction. So if you don't go through those steps, you might not be able to actually sue them for any lost profits when you have to relist the property. Also, the seller normally has an obligation to mitigate or reduce their damages as much as possible. So in the context of a collapsed sale, this means usually that they have to relist the property right away, put it back on the market, and advertise it to the same degree that they did when they had the first sale. So they can't just wait, you know, see if the market's going to pick up and they can make more or something like that and let their damages continue to accumulate, or just sell it at a blowout price to their friend or something like that. They have to go and they have to list it and put it back on MLS and do showings again and all that kind of stuff, so they can show the court if necessary that they made every effort to mitigate their damages.
Yeah, and that probably was the case in Kelowna, because a judge wouldn't nilly-willy grant this kind of a settlement if they didn't feel that seller did their obligation. I mean, a seller can sue for specific performance. I want you to close, but I can't close. Well, I want you to close, and I have to do all of the things necessary from my end that you can close, and then you say, I still can't do it. Okay, then it's my obligation actually to list the property, right? Put it up for sale as soon as possible and not sell it away to some sort of a good close friends at a special deal and then sue the buyer. Generally speaking, a buyer that can't close for that much money probably, you know, wouldn't be possible for him to pay the court fee either, you know. So, but anyways, that's where you have the joys of the legality of it. Well, you are very much involved in daily questions about all sorts of things. I know in the subdivision area, the difficulties right now with sixplexes on any kind of a lot, and I talked to one of the famous Vancouver architects, Michael Geller, who thinks it's gone nuts. He says, every lot, he says, you know, to have this opportunity. But clearly, if you do have a lot that would fall under the provisions of maybe fourplex or a sixplex, you've got to understand the municipal bylaws that come around with that lot and the projections and so on. You can't do it yourself. You definitely need some expert advice, and I would certainly recommend that people call you. Do you have any final thoughts that anybody buying and selling real estate in this environment?
Yeah, I would definitely say make sure that you have a lawyer and an accountant in your corner, and that you engage these people from pillar to post. Have your accountant set you up, you know, let you know what corporate structure or ownership structure you might want to have to own the property, how you want the financing to go in, who's going to be the borrowers, how you want the share structure, if any money's going in as shareholder loans or as capital, or, you know, things that I can't really comment on myself, because that's within the purview of the accountant. But it is important to know so you don't run into tax difficulties at the time you sell. Also, you know, getting a lawyer on board right at the outset's a good idea. And Ozzy, you might not like me saying this given where you're sitting, but you can even ask your lawyer to look at the listing agreement for you. If you're selling a property, or a buyer side agreement, if you want, you can have a lawyer say, look at this agreement with my realtor just to make sure that it's okay, or explain the provisions to me or things like that. There's a whole bunch of clauses in there that people probably don't really read, and they might not really know the consequences. For example, the standard form deal says that even if the property doesn't complete, the listing agent still gets their commission. So if the buyer, as I was mentioning earlier, if the buyer backs out, the agreement technically says that you yeah. still owe the listing their commission. That might be something that you might want to negotiate in some way, especially if you're dealing with a really high value property. If you're dealing with a multi-million dollar property, your real estate commissions could be in the hundreds of thousands of dollars. Yeah. And if your sale doesn't complete, you might not be able to pay your commission to your realtor. So you might have to negotiate that kind of clause, just to cover your bases.
One famous lawsuit right now is a realtor looking for $800,000 in commissions. Now, this is all on a pre-sale, but there's a brand new form out right now that the Real Estate Association put out, which covers GST. Most people think, oh, the buyer pays the GST. It's a given. Well, but if there's a dispute, until now at least, that wasn't clear at all. And so all of a sudden you have removed subjects, you want to close, and now they start haggling over commission, GST. Well, GST on today's world of an average price of $2 million, we're talking $120,000. We're talking big bucks. And so
absolutely.
The new clause is now, the new form that realtors have been advised to, that they must use, is that it's the owner has to pay it unless it's negotiated up front. And this is where it would come in. You've got to see your lawyer beforehand saying, oh, by the way, do you know what you're signing here? If you don't specify that you want the buyer to pay the GST, you're going to pay it.
That's right. And it depends on if people are GST registered or not. And sometimes there's a lot of confusion around these pre-sales. When we were going back to the flipping, for example, if you buy a property and you never live in the property and then you resell it, GST applies again. So
that
a lot
is
of people...
the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard. I agree. I talked about it before. I mean, it's brand new. I paid my GST, but for some reason, 2 months later, I flip it, but I wasn't flipping it. I actually have to sell it. I'm being moved or whatever. Now the GST is due again. What possible reason can they have for that? Other than
I'm not, I did have an accountant explain it to me one time, but I'll confess I didn't really understand the rationale for why it should apply. I know that it does, so I can advise the clients that it does.
They but said there it had comes to do with- the point about getting a GST number is very important too, because at least if you had a GST number in your company, then you can offset maybe the GST. Anyways, the point is it's tricky. And what you said about an accountant, I think, is also absolutely true. I see sometimes very complicated deals, and no accountant was involved to set it up. There was assumptions made what the capital gains tax would be or whether it would apply, and where did they get it from? I don't know. They should set themselves up as good as possible tax-wise. It's a duty each individual in Canada has not to overpay the tax, right? And you do that with an accountant. And then have whatever you created on from a legal sense of view, have your lawyer look at it. No, I'm not against that at all. I think, you know, the more advice you get up front, you might even say after you get all the advice, you know what, I don't really want to do this deal.
Quite possibly. Well, I've always maintained that there's nothing more expensive than a cheap accountant. So,
yeah, or a cheap lawyer. Well, that's an oxymoron. Well, any final words of wisdom?
No, I think that's it. Just hope everybody has some good luck with their upcoming purchases, and it's a tough market. So I wish everybody luck, and I'm always available to field any phone calls, whether it's general or specific. I'm always available.
Well, that's very kind of you. And everybody that's watching it, we have put Stuart's address and email below, and also what he does, what he specializes in. And all of you that are listening to us on the podcast, go to ozbuzz.ca, send me a note, and I will send all the information to you as well, forthwith. Thanks, Stuart. This was a clarifying experience.
Glad to help. Thanks, Ozzy.